This is White Sox Weekly, your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now, here's your host, Jeff Meller.
Welcome on into White Sox Weekly. I am Jeff Meller. As the 2025 season has concluded for your Chicago White Sox, they finish with a 19-win improvement on where they were at in 2024. Of course, a historically bad season in 2024. The White Sox bounce back again with 19 more wins than last season. And I think most White Sox fans would agree objectively they seem like they are moving in the right direction with the organization, as there has been a lot of positives, a lot of rookie debuts by the White Sox this season. You know, we saw a lot of players, first and foremost, who were acquired in the Garrett Crochet deal, come up and make their major league debut. In fact, three-fourths of the Garrett Crochet trade package have already debuted, and I think more than held their own. I'm speaking, of course, of Chase Meidroth, Wilkelmin Gonzalez, and then Kyle Teal, who I think was the most impressive. And then, of course, Braden Montgomery has had an extraordinary season when you consider the fact that Montgomery has played at three different levels in the minor leagues for the White Sox. So that in itself, I think, was a huge accomplishment for the organization as they try and bounce back from what was a very tough 2024 season. Shane Smith, the top selection in the Rule 5 draft for the White Sox, made an immediate impact in his first season. He was an all-star, and I think he's one of the first players I bring up because consider how he closed out the season, right? He certainly started the season very good for the White Sox when he made his first start for them against the Twins. He went 5 2/3 innings, gave up 2 earned runs. He struck out 3, only walked 4 on that day. And all in all, it was an excellent start to begin his major league career. And then consider how he closed it out against the Washington Nationals on the road in an 8-0 victory for the White Sox. Shane Smith, 6 shutout innings. He carried a no-hitter into the 6th inning before finally giving up the lone hit that he gave up on the day. He also struck out tying a career high with 8 Ks on the day. Oh yeah, he did that too in his last start, or second to last start of the season against the Yankees. So in his last 2 starts of the season, Shane Smith went 11 innings. He only gave up 1 run. He struck out 8 in each start. So 16 strikeouts in 11 innings over his final 2 starts. And he was excellent all season long as he was the White Sox All-Star Game representative in Atlanta, an extraordinary achievement for the top pick in the Rule 5 draft. Oh, yeah, by the way, he was the only pitcher to ever have done what I said, where he made an all-star team in the same year that he was selected in the Rule 5 draft. So extraordinary achievement for the White Sox pitching infrastructure and the organization as a whole, identifying Shane Smith's talent as he was a member of the Brewers, and they decided he was going to be their top selection in the Rule 5 draft. So great year by Shane Smith, and the White Sox organization feels very good about where he's at. I said it on the final postgame of the season, would not be surprised at all if Shane Smith ends up being the opening day starter next season, injury permitting, of course. That's always the caveat with pitching. How about hitting? The White Sox, I think, have found quite a few starters, everyday regulars that you can feel good about moving forward. The catchers in particular, I'll get to that in a moment, but I think maybe if you set Shane Smith aside, the story of the season for the White Sox was Colson Montgomery, who in April, at the end of April, seemed like he could not make contact in AAA to save his life. And so the White Sox decided that what was best for Colson was to have a conversation with him and discuss the possibility of leaving Charlotte, leaving AAA, and going to the White Sox Arizona complex and working individually with Ryan Fuller so that Colson Montgomery could rework his swing because he was striking out at an almost 50% clip. And clearly, that was not going to get it done. And a lot of times during a professional baseball season, in a minor league season, it's really hard to reset and get your mind clear when things are going poorly, but you sometimes need that. And I think what the White Sox understood with Colson Montgomery, and it's become very apparent when you look at the way his season played out, was that a reset was best for him. And so they asked him if he would be willing to go work with Ryan Fuller individually to leave AAA Charlotte and just figure out the best swing for him to rework it, remake it. And obviously, when he went back after about a couple week hiatus with Ryan Fuller in Arizona, working with him individually, when he got back to AAA, he had to deal with a lot of hit by pitches, a couple of injuries that kind of delayed his restart again. He would start up, have some success, get hit by a pitch, have to miss a couple of days, restart again, and get his timing back. And eventually, Colson Montgomery got the promotion to the majors, made his major league debut in Colorado against the Rockies on July 4th. And it took a little while for Colson Montgomery to get comfortable at the plate in the majors, but it did not take much time for him to get comfortable in the field. Colson Montgomery made an immediate impact. In fact, on the 4th of July, may have made what was the best defensive play by any White Sox defender all season, diving catch in the outfield. I remember Colson Montgomery saying he had never made a catch like that in the history of his career. And he said it was probably the best catch he's ever made. Crazy that it came in his major league debut. But I think that kind of helped him settle in. And then eventually, what I think helped Colson Montgomery out after getting comfortable at the major league level, he decided after some conversations with people inside the White Sox organization that the torpedo bat, was something that they thought would complement his swing in particular. And so Colson Montgomery, open-minded as we've seen with his work with Ryan Fuller and being able, more than open-minded with the idea of leaving his AAA team and going working with Ryan Fuller. So Colson Montgomery said, okay, you guys think the torpedo bat is something that would work for me? Well, then let's try it. And then sure enough, in his first at bat in Tampa Bay after the All-Star break, Colson Montgomery came back and he actually homered in his first at bat with a torpedo bat. And from then on, I'm not saying it was the torpedo bat. I'm just saying that it certainly unlocked something in Colson's swing. I'm sure it probably made him at ease a little bit when he finally did get that first home run in the big leagues. And when he did, it seems like the floodgates were opened at that point because Colson Montgomery went on to hit 21 home runs in the second half of the season. First player in Major League history to hit 21 home runs after the All-Star game when he had not hit any prior to that. The previous record was set by Gary Sanchez in his first season as a member of the New York Yankees. Sanchez hit 20 home runs after the All-Star break after not hitting any prior to that. Well, Colson Montgomery would come back and hit 21. So he would tie Sanchez and then actually pass him. And he would come up one home run shy of the team lead for home runs. Think about that. Colson Montgomery, a rookie for the White Sox this season, in 255 at-bats, came up just one home run shy of leading the White Sox in home runs this season. Lenin Sosa actually ended up leading the team with 22 home runs. Lenin Sosa had 75 RBIs to lead the team. So for all the praise I'm giving Colson Montgomery and how bright the future looks for Colson Montgomery, Lenin Sosa had a breakthrough season at the plate as well. Now, Lenin Sosa, I think the conversation for him this offseason is going to be about getting better defensively, getting more consistent defensively at second base, also at first base, where he's going to be somebody who I think the White Sox feel good about what he did with the bat, where they're going to want to see him in the lineup moving forward. But again, he's going to have to do some work defensively where he becomes more consistent as a defender at second base and occasionally at first base and have that versatility and flexibility where the White Sox can feel comfortable putting him in the lineups, knowing that defensively he's not going to cost them, because offensively what he gave them with the power, that was certainly a huge breakthrough for Sosa. So that's going to be an interesting thing to watch this offseason about where the White Sox feel Lenin Sosa is going. You know, has he carved out a role as a second baseman for them in the long-term future? I think certainly for the near-term future, he will be, you know, the White Sox second baseman heading into next year. Now, can he make that a more permanent home for the White Sox going forward? I think if that's going to be the case, he needs to improve defensively. But what we saw from him at bat with the power, that was certainly a nice breakthrough for the White Sox. This is Jeff Meller on White Sox Weekly here talking with you as we recap the White Sox season. Plenty to talk to you about here. I'm going to jump into the Major League Baseball playoffs. But up next, Connor McKnight of CHSN will talk to me as we break down the White Sox season right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Let's go.
Carmen and Yurko, weekdays, 9 to noon, ESPN Chicago.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. Hey, White Sox fans, lock in your 2026 ticket plan today. Get access to the best seats at the best value. The biggest matchups, opening day on Thursday, April 2nd, and more. To secure your ticket plan, visit whitesox.com/2026. But before we get ahead of ourselves looking at 2026, of course, we are recapping the 2025 season, and who better to recap the White Sox season with me, none other than the man who held this position before I was here. He is certainly a veteran of White Sox Weekly, Connor McKnight, now doing sidelines for CHSN and, of course, filling in on play-by-play as well. Connor, how the heck are you, my man?
Hey, Jeff. Good to talk with you, as always. I'm a little jealous. I'm a little jealous of you. One of my favorite things to do was the wrap-up show for a season on White Sox Weekly. Like, legitimately. I don't know why, but it always, good or bad season, it always felt good to kind of put a bow on things and see where we were, how far we come, what did and didn't happen, and then kind of have that optimism, you know, for next spring. So thanks for having me on. This is cool.
Well, certainly my pleasure, Connor, and it was always a pleasure watching your smiling face. I never heard what you were saying because, of course, I was doing the radio broadcast or listening to Len and DJ, but it was always fun looking up and seeing you do something on CHSN this past season. And listen, blank canvas. It's yours to paint wherever you want to go. It is the White Sox weekly recap show for the 2025 year. So what was your biggest takeaway from this past season for the White Sox, Connor?
You know, I think going into things last year, we thought we knew a lot about where the state of pitching was headed for the White Sox. And we thought that it would take some time, but that we'd figure out where the position players kind of sat as we exited 2025 and headed into 2026. And what happened by, you know, through a lot of different mechanisms, right? Injury absolutely being one of them, especially on the pitching side. We're less certain of the state of White Sox pitching, though still hopeful, and feeling a lot more certain about what's there offensively with a young core that includes Caro and Teal and Montgomery and others down the line, right? I don't mean to just center it around those couple, but there are certainly others that matter a whole lot that have made some strides. And guys in the minor leagues, too, like Braden Montgomery and Caleb Bonnemer and Sam Antonacci to lesser extent. And it's weird how you go into a season thinking, oh, well, we're going to find this out, and come out of a season having found out something completely different, but also really encouraging. I think it's, you know, if you'd have told me when Colson Montgomery was removed from AAA Charlotte and sent to the Complex League to rework some things, that the guy would have as many home runs as almost anyone in the second half of the season and as many RBI as almost anyone in the second half of the season, I'd have thought you were absolutely crazy. I just would have. And instead, we found out those things. And, oh, by the way, he plays a pretty darn good shortstop, too. I'm really impressed by the way some of the young hitting has come around. Now, certainly there are some things to work on here, right? Colson Montgomery's not a warp-free, you know, young player, nor is he a finished product, both of which are very normal things. And I think you could say the same about a lot of those other young hitters, but I think it's a lot more clear the kind of path that the White Sox need to take here in 2026 for the front office, and that is a good thing. At the end of the day, what you wanted out of 25 was having a much more clear path defined by production and player development, so that the front office kind of knew, okay, these are the appropriate next steps to take. And I think they did get that.
It's interesting because had you told me in April, in the end of April, that Colson Montgomery would have hit 21 home runs in the second half, I would have thought for sure you were talking about in AAA. But for him to do what he did, you know, 21 home runs, no player in the history of baseball had ever hit 21 home runs after hitting zero prior to the All-Star game. For Colson Montgomery to come to the major leagues and be able to accomplish that, far and away exceeded, I think, most people's expectations when you consider where he was at the end of April, to your point about him having to go work with Ryan Fuller individually. That's an extraordinary accomplishment for the White Sox organization. And then, you know, he registers 3.3 wins above replacement in just 71 games. So despite the fact that, you know, the on-base percentage, you know, the hope is that it comes up a little bit, especially with a little bit more experience. But with a 311 on-base percentage to be able to give you 3.3 war in 71 games, I mean, I'm going to raise my hand and sign me up for that each and every season, because that's a hell of a player, even if he is only hitting 239 when all is said and done. But to your point about some of the pitching that we were maybe expecting to be, you know, the linchpin for the White Sox going forward, what's interesting is that I think when we were looking ahead from spring training, nobody was factoring in Shane Smith potentially being the ace of this staff that could lead the way. And so what we saw from him this year was, oh my God. Like, and then to cap it off, you were there in Washington to see it firsthand, the dominance that he had on his last start of the season, the last game of the season for the White Sox. That was spectacular and got me really excited about the future for Shane Smith.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to point that out. And when we said, you know, we'd know so much more about the pitching, or we thought we would, you know, leading into the season, I don't mean to say that what Shane Smith did this year isn't absolutely amazing. I mean, the guy made the All-Star team. He's the first pitcher in baseball history to make the All-Star team in the year he was selected in the Rule 5 draft. Only one other player, Dan Uggla, second baseman for the Marlins back in the day, has done it. You know, a position player and a pitcher, that's it. That's the two guys. And Shane, I think I talked with Shane a lot, especially in the second half of the season, just about, you know, kind of his approach and what he was trying to get done. And, you know, especially after those four or five really rough starts toward the middle of his year leading up to the All-Star break, you know, he was searching for things in a lot of different ways. And I think what was really cool about Shane is that you saw him be very change-up dependent in his run to the All-Star game prior to those, you know, those few bumpy starts, really bad starts. Then he kind of ironed some things out. I think in his last start prior to the All-Star break, it wasn't great, but it looked a hell of a lot better than it had before.
Certainly.
Then comes out the break with an ankle injury, got some time off, much needed. And I think the arsenal changed, man. I mean, he figured out how to not be changeup dependent and still be able to tilt that ball. He figured out how to be, you know, a lot more fastball, sinker, two-seam kind of thing. He absolutely pounded the strike zone. There was that start a few out of the break where he was paired with Corey Lee after he had come back up. I think it was Corey's first catching assignment since coming back up from AAA. And he threw 23 of 25 first-pitch strikes in the first 25 hitters. Like, that's bananas. And I think when you look at where, you know, he got at the end of the season, the bet that he and Davis Martin had about who could throw the most innings at the end of the year, you know, to keep them going, that says a lot about those two, about the starting staff, about the whole pitching side, you know, just looking for every little, you know, competitive edge to keep them moving and trying to win ball games in a season where, you know, at the, you know, going into that Washington series, 63 is the most they could have gotten. You end up with 60 or 62, I guess. And it's just, I love that stuff. I love where his head's at, a competitor. His work is never finished. He is maybe his own harshest critic, which is probably a good thing at his age and level of experience. Plenty of time to mellow that a little bit. You know, you'd rather, it's the old, Don Cooper line. I got to clean it up a little bit for the broadcast, I suppose. But you'd rather tame a tiger, right, than push a donkey, I suppose, is probably the way that Coop would have to say it on it. No, Coop would say whatever he wanted on air.
Sure.
But that's the line, right? And I think that's what you have with Shane a little bit.
Yeah, no, he was fantastic to watch down the stretch, especially when he returned from that injured list stint. You know, he, again, just kind of exuded that ace quality mentality that you're looking for to front your staff. And, I mean, this is, we're far from it, but I would say, you know, barring any injury, he looks like a guy who's going to be the opening day starter for the White Sox. I know you mentioned Davis Martin. Certainly, I'm sure, would love that honor as well. But the way Shane Smith pitched this past season, he feels like an opening day starter to me.
Yeah, I think that absolutely could be the way they go. Obviously, a lot of time between now and then, of sure. course. But like, let's be fair, too, to Shane a little bit. And I think Chris Getz talked about this some in his last press conference before the end of the season. You know, Shane could absolutely earn the opening day start in 26, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they still want to prop up that pitching around him a little bit. And they should, right? Throwing too much on him or really any young pitchers too soon in terms of expectations and all that kind of stuff, it's in some ways not fair. Like, at the end of the day, if you tell me that the White Sox have pulled a three in a starting rotation, kind of your classically defined three starter, third starter out of the Rule 5 draft, that's money. Like, that's insane. That's crazy. And I think that's, you know, if Shane ends up being exactly that, that's fantastic. And he's a, you know, three in the White Sox rotation for years to come. I think what's amazing is that given his velocity and some of the stuff that you said he had, that we talked about, yeah, the ceiling is the roof for Shane Smith, I think, right?
Sure.
And I think that's really cool, too. But, you know, I think there should be and there will be some additions on the pitching side, and maybe even if it's just the bullpen and a starter, those are things the White Sox need to do and seem committed to doing in this offseason.
Connor McKnight joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Of course, you see Connor McKnight on CHSN, all the White Sox broadcasts. But, of course, too, if you're unfamiliar, if you haven't caught on as of late, Connor also hosts his own podcast, Road to the Rate, which I think for White Sox fans is especially critical if you want to be up to date on what's going on around the minor leagues and something that you've kind of been touching on, but we haven't really dug into. You know, Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith, I think they're the two players who a lot of White Sox fans have kind of anxiously been awaiting. And I know Chris Getz, you mentioned his end of the season press conference or media session that he had where he talked about, you know, the idea that I think initially the belief was, hey, maybe Hagen Smith and Noah Schultz could break camp with the opening day roster in 2026. Now, that might be something that is not necessarily at the forefront right now because of the seasons they've had. But there's still, I think, a lot of optimism surrounding Hagen Smith and Noah Schultz. What are your thoughts about the uneven season that both players had?
Well, first of all, I appreciate you pumping the pod there a little bit. And because we get to talk about him, I actually talked with Paul Janisch, the director of the farm for the White Sox yesterday for our podcast, which is coming out, early next week.
Okay.
So that's going to drop then. And we talked a lot about Hagen and Noah Schultz. And I can summarize what Paul kind of said about both of them, the top two pitchers in the White Sox organization right now. They still expect big things from them. And yeah, you know, you had hurdles along the way and something the White Sox have, you know, I think a lot of organizations do this. I don't think the White Sox are alone in this, but because of where they are, how they talk about it stands out a little bit more. The White Sox as a front office and Paul especially are really, really up front about embracing the struggle that you might have in the minor leagues and, you know, kind of looking at that as silver lining, as areas to learn, as those things that you can kind of move on from and understand how players are trying to beat you. And whether that's Colson Montgomery going back down to the fall league or going down to the complex or Braden Montgomery, you know, each promotion he had struggles, you know, when he got up to Winston-Salem for about 2.5 weeks and we got up to Birmingham for about 3 weeks. There were real struggles there. Then he fixed the issues. Then he started demolishing baseballs. And for Hagen and Noah, you know, Schultz is a little bit different than this, having pitched with the knee tendonitis for a little while here and really kind of, you know, injury, as you know, Jeff, is a lot different than struggling with other stuff that's going on. But with Hagen, you know, he was able to compete. He was still able to get strikeouts. The stuff is there. There's going to be walks in his game, it looks like. But I think for both guys, the hope inside the organization is very much that they can be major leaguers in 26 if things go right. And that's just kind of talent that they've got. And I think this is a big offseason for both of them going forward in order to get A, healthy, right? Hagan had some health issues pop up as well. And B, you know, kind of refocused and re-energized and have a good spring coming into next year.
How about Grant Taylor, Connor? Because he made the ascension to the majors, and by the end of the season, especially after that groin issue, looked like he certainly could acclimate nicely to a closer, or if you just want to go ahead and say modern baseball, like a high leverage arm that you're counting on here, you know, late in innings. That's certainly the kind of the scenario I envision for him. But I know that he's talked a lot about he still has the mind frame that he can be a starter in this league. How do you think the White Sox approach Grant Taylor in terms of being a starter or reliever here in the future?
Yeah, it sounds to me like reliever for the near future for sure. And I think Grant and everybody else kind of around him in his orbit kind of understand and talk about the idea of being a starter at some point in the future, but maybe not now. And when you look at the larger picture for the White Sox in terms of you know, the pitching that's going to be available to them in 26 at a major league level, you've got three guys in Drew Thorpe, Kai Bush, and Mason Adams who are all coming back from Tommy John surgeries at some point during the major league season. And while they're probably going to need some run-up in the minors, obviously Thorpe and Bush being the only one of those who have seen major league time, and not a whole lot of it, you probably want some seasoning on them before they become, you know, stakes in the bigs. But they've got a lot of guys on innings limits or nearing them or kind of like with injury concerns coming back from Tommy John. You're going to have to manage some innings here. And if you were to put Grant in a starting rotation for 2026, he would be another guy that you've got to be concerned about an innings base on, right? And maybe limit isn't the right way to talk about this. Maybe we should talk about more of as an innings base. You know, how far can you go based on how much you pitched last year? And that's just, you know, that's just good business sense from both a financial standpoint and an injury management standpoint. And I don't think the White Sox really want to throw another guy, talented as Grant may be, onto a situation where you're dealing with an innings base issue going into 26. Especially when, you know, a leisure Taylor, you know, kind of back end of a bullpen looks pretty good from where I'm standing right now, you know, bullpen additions notwithstanding.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Especially when you consider so many close 1 and 2 run losses. If you can start mm-hmm. the season with guys like Taylor and Leisure at the back end of the bullpen and then build out from there, I think you feel really good about where Will Venable can go with this pitching staff. Last thing, Connor, as I spring you here, your thoughts on the coaching changes that the White Sox announced at the end of the season. Anything surprise you? Or listen, a lot of those guys were holdovers from Pedro Grifol's staff, and the reality was that Will Venable, probably just like almost any manager around the league, probably wants some of his own guys in place.
Yeah, I think that's part of it for sure. I mean, that's the business side of this game that is, you know, it's no fun. You know, you spend a lot of time with these guys throughout the course of the year. The coaching staff spends a lot of time together. You build relationships. You talk to these guys. You really kind of appreciate the way they talk about the game and teach me about the game in a lot of instances with Marcus and Ethan for sure. I suppose of the moves, if we're rating surprise, Ethan Katz moving on is probably the most surprising, though no, not all that much. You know, like you say, it's, you know, you come to the end of the contract, you have a new management, you essentially have a new front office that was kind of, you know, in between things, and as much as in the business of player acquisition and bringing in a coaching staff was also kind of setting a foundation for the organization that hadn't been around the way they wanted it to be for a while. So, you know, you kind of do what you do. I don't think Ethan Katz will remain unemployed for very long. I think he's a very good pitching coach, though perhaps not the one the White Sox wanted going forward or needed going forward, I suppose. And on the hitting side, you know, listen, I wonder where things would have been as an organization had Ryan Fuller been brought in a year earlier. Now, obviously, that's not a thing that was on the table, right? He was still working for the Orioles yep. at the time as a co-hitting coach, and you know, it's not like they had that chance. But the White Sox waited for their guy, got their guy, and now are trying to, you know, line everything up, both, you know, in terms of their ducks in a row contractually and getting all the philosophies, you know, kind of from the top down. I know they like Joel McKeeson, the assistant hitting coach. Matt Wise, you know, was the bullpen coach, assistant pitching coach, too. Perhaps those are options after, you know, searching around and looking for more and obviously trying to bring in the best coaches that you can. I think this is, you know, very much an organization, a front office, and a management, or a manager rather, and bench coach, and Walker McKinven, that know what they want going forward, and are really trying to be aggressive here because of the things we talked about to start, you know, about the understanding. The White Sox have a much clearer vision of the future because some of these young players have produced and now kind of understand what they need going forward.
All right, Connor, for real, last one here. This is not White Sox related. Anything stand out from the MLB wild card round that got your attention?
Umpiring?
ABS coming?
Can it be that simple? No, I mean, I don't want to listen. It's a hard job and whatever. But, you know, it's funny. Len and DJ and I were just texting about this a little while ago. And I said it on White Sox Weekly when the format expanded. I'm not a fan of expanded playoffs. I don't like. I don't think it provides what. I don't think it provides the best teams in the playoff format. I get why we're doing it, and I'm, you know, it's kind of like the zombie runner on second base in the 10th, right? I can't stand it, but I understand why we're doing it, and I can get behind it in terms of, like, you know, trying to win baseball games and go ahead in series and whatnot. This format just doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't feel like the rest of the playoffs to me. It doesn't feel like the rest of baseball. It feels like we're going to get to these divisional series, and now the gear shifter just kind of drops back into third, and it feels like the playoffs we've all come to know. And I don't know. It's just an uneven process for me right now, and I'm not wild about it. I wish the umpiring were better. I do think that pretty loudly, sure. But it's just not my cup of tea yet. Maybe I just need to let it cool down a little bit.
No, it's definitely interesting for sure. Connor McKnight, as always, I appreciate your time today here on White Sox Weekly. As always, thank you, my friend.
A pleasure. Anytime. Have a great winter. Thanks for having me.
All right. You do the same, Connor. Again, Connor McKnight joining us here on White Sox Weekly. You see him on CHSN, and you can catch the Road to the Rate podcast, where White Sox fans, obviously, if you're keeping up to date on what's going on in the minor league system, Connor has all the latest information for you right there. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly. Plenty more to come right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
I want to first start off by saying, obviously, we all miss Jinx. Wish he was here. And I promise you, if he was here, he'd be sitting on top of my head, making faces at me, spitting spitballs in my face, trying to get to make me laugh. And but yeah, we're going to miss him. And, you know, rest in peace, brother. For the rest of my teammates that are here, whoever the genius was to have both of these things in the same weekend, thank you for making me look good when they're all actually here, because half of them probably wouldn't be. But thank you guys for being here and supporting me. Lou, you and your team, you guys are really easy to work with. Obviously made an incredible sculpture. If anybody's looking for a statue for their front yard, I would recommend, not of me, of yourself, go see Lou and he can make one for you. And also Reifert, dealt with him a lot during hunting season, trying to make phone calls, getting me up here, getting pictures and a lot of stuff. And, you know, I'm usually in the woods, so it was a hassle going back and forth trying to get all that worked out. Front office, White Sox front office, from the day that I've got here, from me, my family, friends, you guys have taken care of us above and beyond up until this point today, I mean, and probably from here on out. So I can't thank you guys enough, not even just the front office, security guards, ushers. I mean, anybody we've run into, you guys have been outstanding to us, so thank you. My parents, obviously mom and dad are here. My kids, thank you guys. I'm proud of the way you guys have grown up to most of the time be sweet children. My wife for holding down the fort, making me and the kids look halfway decent for this trip, because he wouldn't have recognized me if it was up to me. And obviously Jerry, I mean, getting a number retired is one thing, and then now this. I'm not the smartest person to come up with the words to express my gratitude for this. I mean, I want to say thank you, but I don't feel like that's enough. But This is an incredible freaking honor. So thank you very much. And then obviously, fans, you guys made it easy. You guys made it easy for to go out there and perform, pitch, do what I did. Obviously, I had some more cheers than boos, but I had my moments of boos too. But I can't thank you guys enough, and love you, Chicago.
It's simple. The ESPN Chicago app.
Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly. Sox fans, sign up to become a White Sox insider and get special offers, single game ticket pre-sales, and other exciting Sox content delivered free to your inbox. Visit whitesox.com/insider today. Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly as we recap the 2025 season. One of the fun parts about doing the White Sox pregame show each and every Sunday, Len Casper would have his Sunday spotlight where he would pick somebody from around Major League Baseball and bring you inside their world a little bit. And one of my favorite ones from this past season was his Sunday spotlight with Davis Martin. Now, Davis Martin actually happened to be pitching that Sunday, but Len sat down and recorded with Davis Martin on Friday about his routine. And what was so interesting to me was this aired back on August 17th, which again was a Sunday that Davis Martin made a start against the Kansas City Royals. And it was actually Davis Martin's best start of the season. So on our pregame show, you actually got to hear from the starting pitcher prior to his start about his day-to-day routine. And I'll give you the stat line. Davis Martin actually ended up throwing a one-hitter. He went 6 shutout innings, one hit allowed. He struck out 4 on the day. He walked 3, but was actually really good against the Royals, a game that the White Sox would ultimately end up losing. But Davis Martin ended up being really good that day. On the season, I thought Davis Martin had a really nice year. Ended up 2nd on the White Sox pitching staff, just behind Shane Smith in terms of innings pitched, which I think is, in a lot of ways, the best way to measure a pitcher's worth to a team these days, especially starters, because we're in the day and age when so infrequently are pitchers allowed to go deep in the ball game. So you really want to know how a pitcher's doing on the season. Kind of just check their innings pitched and see where they relate into the rest of the team's staff. And Davis Martin actually just missed leading the White Sox in innings pitched this season. In fact, he was leading on the final day until Shane Smith went out and absolutely dominated against the Nationals in his final start of the season. But Davis Martin was 2nd on the White Sox staff in innings pitched at 142 and two-thirds innings this year. He made 25 starts, 26 appearances in all, with one opener for one of his starts, or I guess one of his appearances earlier this season. Nevertheless, though, Davis Martin took Len Casper through his routine prior to a start, and I thought it was really interesting to hear a major league starter talk you through how he mentally and physically prepares for one of his starts.
The idea is for the fans maybe to live with you during your in-between start routine. And let's start this way. How routine-oriented or, quote, rigid do you feel like you are in between starts?
Yeah, I definitely think I'm kind of in the middle. I know there's some guys that are super lax in their routine, and there's some guys that if one detail of a 5-day routine of gets thrown off, the whole week's thrown off. So I like to build a little bit of cushion in there for, you know, things that you can't control via travel, via anything that life kind of throws at you, especially with a 2-year-old at home. So yeah, definitely in the middle.
So your checklist, let's start with the day after a start.
Yeah, day after the start, you're basically just trying to put your body back together. For anybody that knows, after throwing 100 pitches, you usually don't feel too good. So that's, you know, mobility, that's soft tissue, that's tubs, that's sleep, that's anything that you can do under the sun to kind of put yourself back together. And from the baseball side of things, you know, I really like to do a scouting report on the next team on day one. It's just a good way to mentally kind of separate myself from the previous outing, good or bad, you know. Because I think some guys can get kind of caught up in the last outing in both categories. You're never as good as you think you are, and you're never as bad as you think you are. And so it's a good way to kind of mentally disconnect from the previous outing and kind of get your eyes going to forward.
How much video do you watch of yourself compared to video of hitters that you face?
I'd say it's probably 90% video of people I face and about 10% of me. I think video from people I face, you know, you're looking at end zone misses. What are they chasing? Where are they chasing it? Why are they chasing it? You know, pitch before is a fastball. What are they doing after that? You know, and the only time I watch video of myself is usually closer to my starts. You know, visualization is really big in our sport, and I'm not a very good mental visualization guy, so I have to go in and just see myself actually doing things, getting guys out, swinging and missing. So that's more of like a late in the routine, kind of just build the confidence up going into the next start.
A former big leaguer, left-hander Mark Redman, once told me when he watched video of himself, he would never watch bad stuff. He said it was only positive. Is that true for you?
Absolutely. You know, you can. The fun thing is about our apps that we use for our film, you can put outs. And so it's, you know, it's the line drives at 110 at somebody. It's the strikeouts. It's the dribblers. It's the broken bats. It's, you know, reminding yourself, hey, I'm pretty good at this sport, and I can do pretty cool things as well. So it kind of gets you in the right mental headspace before a start.
That makes sense. All right, so days 2, 3, 4, what are you doing in there in terms of throwing?
Yeah, 2, 3, 4, you're going to mix a long toss day and a bullpen day, and then kind of like a light primer day. So, you know, long toss day, kind of loosen everything up. You know, if you want to air it out, you can. Bullpen day, okay, you know, let's keep hammering our strengths. Maybe look at the weaknesses of some of the hitters coming up. Maybe try to hit that a little bit. And then your primer day, you're basically short, sweet, low volume, high intensity, kind of get the arm moving quick and kind of prime yourself for the next day.
And then the day of your start, let's say it's a night game, you wake up and you do what?
Be a father. So, yeah, no, I, you know, it's fun because I think being a dad kind of disconnects. You know, you're not thinking about baseball, and, you know, you're running around. He has a baseball glove. You're playing catch. He puts his football helmet on. You're throwing the football. You know, you're running. You're having fun. You know, and then kind of around 11 or 12 o'clock, you kind of start getting those nerves, start really hitting hard. And my wife does a really good job of kind of realizing that, and she says, all right, good luck. Go get them. And once I feel like I can't be a dad, I try to go to the field. And so we have a nice little strong, you know, cutoff there, and I can let all those emotions kind of start riding out. So, but yeah, and that's right around 12 or 1 is when I really try to start making sure the anxiety's hitting, because that's when I throw best, is when I'm pretty anxious, which is always good.
Last question, the day of a start, are you superstitious in terms of something you'll wear, something you'll eat, anything like that?
Not at all. You know, I had a pitching coach in college named Ray Hayward, pitched for the Rangers, the Expos, and he said, I love going against all my superstitions. And, you know, if I had a good outing, I'd wear the different colored socks the next week, because he's like, you don't want to be tied to those things. So just not putting mental energy into that kind of stuff and just controlling what you control and have fun.
Again, that was Len Casper's Sunday Spotlight with White Sox starter Davis Martin earlier this year. I'm Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. Let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly, recapping the 2025 White Sox season here with you. When we come back, we are in the thick of the Major League Baseball playoffs as the divisional series has now begun. I want to talk a little bit about the wild card round and what we saw from around the majors right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Black and Abdallah, 2 p.m. weekdays, ESPN Chicago.
Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly. Hey, join us next season to celebrate your special occasion in 2026 with a White Sox suite outing. Reserve your suite today to get access to the best locations and top matchups like opening day on April 2nd, plus big matchups against the Cubs, Dodgers, and Yankees. For more information, visit whitesox.com/suites or call 312-674-1000. Speaking of the Cubs, Dodgers, and Yankees, and the MLB playoffs. We just wrapped up the wild card round, and we are in the thick of it now as the division series begin today. And I have to say, there's a lot of things you can criticize Major League Baseball for. I loved the playoff rounds. And now we can argue, and I think we will here in a minute, Jack McGrath, who's producing White Sox Weekly with me today here. I think he's got a valid point about the Major League Baseball playoffs. But what I do want to say is I will commend Major League Baseball because I like the format now where the top two teams in each league receive a bye and then the four additional teams that make it from each league. So seeds 3 through 6 play in a best of three series, and the higher seed for each round has all three, if needed, home games. And all three were needed except in one series. The only series where it was not needed was the Dodgers and Reds. Dodgers took care of Cincinnati in 2 games. But the Tigers and Guardians, how about that? The Cleveland Guardians have a great comeback, the greatest comeback in the history of baseball in terms of games back that a team came from behind to overcome and still win their division. The Guardians made up 15 and a half games. They come all the way back. They win the division on the final day of the season, only to have the Tigers beat them in the best of three series. Cleveland had home field, so at Progressive Field, the Tigers go and beat the Guardians in 3 games. Of course, we had the Yankees and Red Sox showdown in the Bronx. Yankees beat the Red Sox 2-1. After Garrett Crochet powered the Red Sox to a game 1 victory, the Yankees came back and won the next 2. And then the Cubs beat the Padres 2-1 at Wrigley, as the Wrigley Field faithful certainly seemed to help the Cubs in their final game, their game 3 win over the Padres. That certainly seemed to fuel them. What I liked was, I just like the format now of playing 3 straight days where it feels more just like baseball to me. A 3-game series. The one thing about the Major League Baseball postseason is it does kind of morph into a whole, I don't want to say different sport, but what your team is built for in the regular season, oftentimes it's not the same thing when you hit the playoffs, right? All of a sudden, a 5 or 7-game series kind of changes the entire dynamic of what your team has been built for in the regular season. And so I did enjoy the wild card format where you had those 3 games. And what was pretty cool was that for the first time in Major League history, on Thursday, we had 3 elimination games. Yes, the Tigers beat the Guardians in their game 3. The Cubs beat the Padres in their game 3. And then the Yankees beat the Red Sox in the nightcap to advance, which sets up a Tigers-Mariners ALDS. You have a Yankees-Blue Jays ALDS. And then in the NLDS, you have the Dodgers at the Phillies, and then the Cubs at the Brewers, setting up an I-94 showdown in the between the two NL Central foes. So I like the fact, too, that the 1 and 2 seeds have this built-in advantage where they get the bye. And I don't think there's always the conversation about, you know, rest versus rust, right? Do you want to be well-rested, or are you concerned about the rust? Well, what I think is these 3-game series put these teams in position where they have to exhaust their bullpen. You only have 1 off day in between the completion of the wild card and the DS, and assuming it goes 3 games. And then all of a sudden, you're right back into the throes of it. And I really liked the fact that the Tigers, Yankees, Cubs, those 3 at least, had to exhaust their bullpen to get through this, and now they come into the LDS of their respective leagues, and they're behind the 8-ball, but it's not so dramatic that it feels like it's impossible to overcome. So I think even though we can quibble about whether or not you like 6 teams coming from each league, I like the way Major League Baseball has structured their format, and I especially like the fact that we didn't have these alternating days where there was a day off in between each series. In the past, that seems like that's something they looked to do to create an extra day of playoff baseball. I feel like oftentimes in years past, you would have seen Major League Baseball split the series up in between leagues so that you would have had some games being played on Friday. I like that they did not do that this year. They just went 3 straight games, which again, I think also feeds into the being for the teams that who did not receive the bye, it's this extra added element where you're like, okay, you've got to play 3 straight games if you go to a 3rd game. and you're going to have to use your bullpen, and just that's the tax on not having been one of the top two seeds. Jack McGrath, who is producing White Sox Weekly with me here today, feels I think a little bit differently. But well, what was your thought on the postseason, in particular the wild card round?
Yeah, well, I agree with your comments about the format. The 3 days back to back to back is phenomenal. It feels like March Madness basketball because you have game after game after game, and they all kind of end at different times, so you get to see good endings back to back to back. And as you said, it taxes the bullpen. It forces a team to have bullpen depth because you don't have these days off where you can just, if you're the Red Sox, for example, throw Aroldis Chapman 3 days in a row just because he's going to throw out his arm if you do that. Or
which real quick to emphasize that point, makes it more like regular season baseball.
Exactly. You can't throw, if you're the Padres, you can't throw Mason Miller 3 days in a row because he's going to blow out his arm if you do that. So you can't do that in those scenarios, which makes it more like a regular season baseball. What I don't like about it, and to your point about the starting pitching too, like Scooble's not going to be able to pitch game one against Seattle on normal rest unless Detroit decides to throw him on short rest, but he's not going to be able to pitch game one on normal rest in this game because they had to use him in that wild card game. So it changes things. But on that series, I think it's too many teams, and it doesn't penalize teams enough for a bad regular season. I think we're getting closer and closer to a 500 team sneaking into the Major League Baseball playoffs in one of those wild card spots. I mean, the Tigers only wound up with 87 wins this year. That's not good enough in most years to be a playoff team, but because of the expanded playoffs, it is for the Detroit Tigers, and their penalty for dropping a 15.5 game lead to the Cleveland Guardians wasn't that they were out of the playoffs. It was that now they have to play those same games that they would have played anyways, most likely.
Just on the road. Yeah.
Which completely throws it off. I feel like the division winners need to be more rewarded for what they've done, even if it's the third division winner, than what they're getting right now. I think there's too many teams. I liked it when it was just five. Maybe throw those two top wildcard teams in a three-game series is okay with me if it's not going to be the one-game do-or-die elimination game. But I just think there's too many teams, and we've expanded it too much, where winning, making the playoffs isn't as celebrated as it once was because it's a lot easier for these teams to do now. And I think there should be a little more challenge to it. I don't want that many teams in the postseason.
So I will agree with you, Jack, in the sense that I think there's certainly, when you just, listen, I don't even know if you're old enough to, because you've probably basically been alive throughout there's probably been wild cards almost your entire life, right?
Yeah, as far as I've known, there's been a wild card team, at least one.
I'm old enough to remember back in the day when there were four divisions and each division winner, you went straight to the LCS. And that truly did reward a fantastic regular season. In fact, there were plenty of years, and White Sox fans can certainly attest to this. You'll remember, they'll remember, like I do, in the, late 80s, early 90s, the White Sox, unfortunately, guess what? The Oakland Athletics were in your division, and they were a juggernaut. And you know what? The AL West, back in the day, the White Sox would finish in second place, and it was too bad, so sad. Guess what? You're not 92 wins, and you're going home at the end of the season. And that was the reality of the Major League Baseball playoffs, was that you'd – and this is, of course, people who are listening who are even older than I am can just probably go back and say, you know what, Meller, I remember a day when there were two leagues, no divisions, and you won the pennant – and that had significance because winning the pennant meant you won your league, and that meant you went straight to the World Series. And, maybe if you're younger, you don't necessarily know the history of baseball. A quick caveat, part of the reason, and listen, they certainly won plenty, but part of the reason why the Yankees have so many World Series championships was because once they won the American League, all they had to do was win one best of seven series in order to win the World Series. They didn't need to make it through the gauntlet that is now the Major League Baseball playoffs. And to Jack's point about it feeling more like March Madness or, just these expanded playoffs across sports, in baseball in particular, right? You look through it all the time. You watch regular season baseball all the time. The Colorado Rockies can beat any particular team you know, two out of three games, and nobody would bat an eye at that, because that's the reality of baseball, is oftentimes, you know, a bad baseball team can beat a really good baseball team two out of three games. There's a randomness to baseball, you know, especially when you consider the best players in the sport only reach base four out of every 10 times they come to the plate, you know, and even then, you know, they're walking one of those four times. So they're not able to do this type of damage that you can in other sports. For instance, in football, the best player on your team, if we're talking quarterbacks, gets to touch the ball half the number of plays. His defense will be on the field the other half, but for the most part, the quarterback of your team has the ball in his hands every offensive play, which allows you to dictate kind of terms as to how that game's going to play out. Same deal in basketball, right? The best players on the best teams have the ball in their hand each and every possession. Baseball, you can't really do that. Your best player only gets to go to the plate one out of every nine times. And so there's a randomness to baseball that when you expand the playoffs, you're just not going to always have the best teams come through. That's the reality of the game. And so to your point, Jack, about like why it doesn't, you know, I guess I'm trying to remember how you phrased it. Just, it doesn't, you lose the importance of the...
You lose the importance of the regular season. You cheapen the regular season games or the regular season standings or the importance of a divisional win, yeah, unless you're one of those top two teams, just because it doesn't matter as much. You can still get in the playoffs with a much worse record than you were able to before. And I get it. I understand it. I understand why they do it. But you play 162 games.
Yeah.
I think that should be a lot more meaningful than the three-game series that you play at the end of the season.
I certainly understand that. And, of course, worth noting that back in the day, in 2005, when this is something we've been talking about quite a bit here today as we kind of reflect on the 2005 season, which was in many ways a celebration for the entire 2005 season, the 20th anniversary of the White Sox World Series championship in 2005. I've been talking a lot about that, replaying some of the best moments from this past season and, you know, giving you just a look into what we've seen so far this year. And there's plenty more of that to come, actually, as we're going to let you hear from Ozzie Guillen and Scott Podsednik as they were in the booth with Len Casper and Darren Jackson earlier this season. So more to come about that. But what I was thinking about and looking at was this week in particular in 2005 was the anniversary of the White Sox series win, or I guess this upcoming week will be, but starting on October 4th, that was October 4th, 2005, that was game one of the White Sox and Red Sox. And in particular, that game for me as a Sox fan in 2005 was really when I truly started to believe that, yes, the White Sox could come and actually win the World Series, because they beat the 2004 World Series champions, the Boston Red Sox. It felt like when the White Sox were going into that matchup that it was going to be, at least I was a little bit concerned, because you're going up against the reigning World Series champions who had just broken a curse. And I was like, I remember at the time being like a little concerned. And then the White Sox came out and crushed the Red Sox in game one, 14-2, which started to give me belief. And that reminded me, speaking of 2005, earlier this year, when the White Sox had the celebration of the 2005 World Series championship team, A.J. Pierzynski came back to right field, and he talked about that game in particular being monumental for that White Sox belief.
The biggest game for me was game one of against Boston, when we hammered them. And because I remember before that game, the guys were like so nervous because we didn't have a lot of guys that had played in the postseason. And I was like, what is wrong with all y'all? I'm like, oh, I didn't sleep, because I'm like, dude, it's the same thing. We went out and scored like five in the first. And then you could just feel like a huge sigh of relief off the whole team. And then from there in the playoffs, it just built and built and built. And once Blum obviously made that swing, it was like, all right, we got this. It's over.
If memory serves, my question to AJ was, did you guys know heading into the playoffs that you were going to win the World Series? And he said, no, you never know. But that's when he had some belief that the team could do it, is when they absolutely crushed the Red Sox. So kind of just a fun little moment of this season as we reflected on the 2005 season quite a bit this past year, as it was the 20th anniversary of the White Sox winning the World Series back in 2005. Hey, Sox fans, sign up to become a White Sox insider. Free registration includes special offers, exclusive ticket pre-sales, and access to other exciting Sox content. Plus, you'll automatically be entered in the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for a chance to win one-of-a-kind experiences all season long. Learn more at whitesox.com/insider. I mentioned Ozzy and Scott Podsednik joining Ozzy Guillen, joining Len Casper and Darren Jackson in the booth earlier this season. We'll let you hear that when we come back on White Sox Weekly, right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The Rich Eisen Show, weekdays, noon to 2, ESPN Chicago.
Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly. Stay up to date on all things White Sox by following the team's official social media accounts. Don't miss a minute of the action on and off the field. Follow the @ White Sox on social today. Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly as we are in the thick of the Major League Baseball playoffs, of course. White Sox Weekly, so talking a lot about the season that has unfolded for the White Sox that is now in the books as they look ahead at the 2026 season and reminiscing about some of the great moments from this past season, including, of course, the celebration of the 2005 World Series championship winning team. Of course, back on the weekend of July 11th, the White Sox unveiled the Mark Burley statue, and then the next day on the Saturday afternoon after they unveiled that, of course, the White Sox celebrated the entire 2005 World Series championship team. And one of the moments that was the best of the season, including everything that happened on the broadcast, Len Casper and Darren Jackson welcomed Ozzy Guillen and Scott Podsednik into the booth together. It was a great moment. It was just fun to step back and listen to Ozzy and Scotty Pods basically have a conversation between themselves, remembering that 2005 season. And you'll hear Len and DJ interspersed with some of the play-by-play, but it was just fantastic to listen to Ozzy and Scotty Pods talk about that magical run that the White Sox had. And I'll bring it back now to July 11th when Ozzy Guillen and Scott Podsednik joined Len Casper and Darren Jackson inside the booth on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
So Ozzy's with us, Scott Podsednik is with us, and I got a bone to pick with Ozzy, if I may.
Let him have it.
All right. Well, hang on. You know, we were together in Florida.
Yes!
Yes, we were.
You're talking about rings.
It's called strike. So Ozzy kept talking about, you know, the fundamentals, doing the right stuff, the small ball, steal bases. Scott, you did all that stuff. And then you get in the postseason and you hit the ball over the fence.
He was cork.
Ozzy never talked about the home runs.
That's a funny thing, guys.
Fouled back, still two strikes.
We hit a lot of home runs.
Yes, you did.
But a couple of days ago, I watched, and we lead the American League, obviously, National League, the pitcher had bunt.
Right.
We lead the American League in sacrifice bunt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I said, look here, sacrifice bunt, good defense, good pitching, steal bases. Yeah. That's the reason we had the man next to me.
Yes.
I talked to Kenny, I said, well, we need more speed. But we hit home runs. But in the end of the day, it was pitching, defense, and good baseball.
Yeah. Well, tweaking you. You did everything, which was why you guys were so great.
What you wanted was more versatility. The year prior, you guys led the league in home runs.
Yes.
Swing and a miss, strike three, one away.
05. We were fifth in home runs that year. We hit 200 home runs. So we could pop the ball out of the ballpark, but we also had the ability to manufacture a run. When it was a close game, we had guys who could handle the bat, understood their row, could hit behind runners, get guys over. And everybody keeps talking about the small ball. That's what
it was a small ball.
We were playing baseball.
That's right. You know, funny, because I just talked to Tadahiro Iguchi. Finally, I started speaking Japanese. Talk to Japanese straight to him and need interpreter.
Cantonese.
Finally,
20 years later.
I talked to interpreter to say the key of this ball club, it was a pitching.
Yeah.
But the offense, well, we have great kid hits. I didn't mean like we win a lot of games by one run, but the soon Posehn's on base, Tarahiro do whatever he does, move the guy over, steal the bases. We do a lot of things. Oh, obviously, pitching was not the starter. Yes. People not remember about the guys in the bullpen.
Oh, come on. Cots, Polite.
Oh, my Polite. God. Amazing. This is like Damaso Marte,
yes.
Vizcaino. You know what I mean? They don't remember those type of guys, the bench we have. And
Dustin Hermanson.
It's a funny thing because this team didn't do themselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like Ozzy said, nope, they did it to themselves. They respect each other, love each other, they play for each other. And that's what you need. You need. And hopefully, I said that in the air today. Hopefully, the Major League Baseball, the White Sox team, seeing those guys.
Yeah.
Like, they see those guys like older, obviously.
Yes.
Everybody know how to. Body like Posehn.
Yes.
I said, if those guys did it, we can do it.
Yeah.
And I want them to see that tomorrow when they go to the field
right.
to present that day.
3-2 coming to Stephen Kwan, swinging a hard ground ball past Sosa and out into right center for a base hit.
This guy is always on base.
He's always on base. Scott, was in the clubhouse the other day, and I told Austin Slater, nice sack bunt. It was the second of your career. He goes, really? I thought I had bunted a little more often. And Michael A. Taylor chimed in, and he goes, why is it that you get into October against tough pitching and one-run games and the manager asks you to bunt, and he hasn't asked you to bunt in 6 months? And his point was, why don't we bunt more in the regular season to kind of get ready for the bigger games? And I thought it was a really interesting, almost obvious observation that I had never heard.
Well, you bring up a really good point. You get caught up in the day-to-day grind of the regular season. When you get to the postseason, games are different. There's a higher expectation. You're going to see good starting pitching. You're going to see good arms out of the bullpen. And you're going to have the ability to work a run in here and there. You happen to pop one out of the ballpark, that's great. But you're going to have to play baseball, like you mentioned. And you're right. I feel like that year we played so many 1-2-3-run ball games, tight ball games, that we were battle-tested and ready for those close, tight ball games in the postseason. And because of that versatility, yeah, we'd get a big home run from Jermaine Canerco here. But, again...
From you?
But we had the ability to manufacture one as well, no question.
I see a couple of days ago all the stuff I did, and I feel proud because not Aussie baseball. That's the way we should... Guys supposed to bunt, they had to bunt it. I remember we scored 3 runs against Kansas. I saw it on TV. I never watched myself. I never watched the team. My kids made me watch the episode. Then a couple of days ago, all of a sudden, Willie Harris, bunt. He come to hit, Posehn going to be on my first and second, bunt.
Yes.
Now we have first and second. They throw ball away. We score 5 runs in that inning because we bunt the right way.
But, Ozzy, but you bring up a good point, and what I think is important as well is the players embrace that and they understand their role and they understand who they are when they come to the ballpark. What do they have to do that night to win a ball game? I feel like we had a lot of unselfish guys. We checked our ego at the door. We all have egos, right? But we did not let our ego get in the way of doing what was needed that particular night to win a ball game. Because you got to do different things each and every night. You got to be versatile. You got to be fluid. You got to be able to do different things. And that ball club had the acumen and the understanding of what it took to win a ball game.
That's a reason I'm getting a little upset with this ball club. They're teaching it. How to play baseball.
Yes.
All the song, they don't move the guy over. Listen, move the guy over. We're going to lose on drinking. That's fine.
Right.
Development about winning.
You're preaching to the choir over here.
Yeah.
This is all, that's all he talks about. Yeah, situational
and like,
hitting.
Development of winning. I said, move the guy over. Put the guy in. When you see Paul Konerko, one of the best hitters in baseball besides Frank Thomas. Frank Thomas don't have nobody even close to him. But nobody be close to Frank Thomas with this uniform on. Nobody. Better hit than Frank Thomas. Now than ever. Frank Thomas is Jesus Christ for the White Sox. Nobody would be better than them. But when you see PK, JD, try to hit bend the second base, try to hit the ball to right field.
Yes.
Everybody say, hey, if I did it, you better do it.
Right.
And that made my job very easy.
It sets a tone and it sets a standard of how we're going to go about our business here.
No doubt. So long at bat, thankfully. Hey, that's okay. The play-by-play can wait. This is more important.
What did I tell you when I joined the White Sox in 94? What about Frank Thomas?
Oh, exactly what Ozzy said.
Yeah.
And you'd been around.
I've been around a lot of future Hall of Famers prior to that, and I'm like, I've never seen anything like this.
Well, Frank, I was his.
That's out of play.
I was the pain in the butt to Frank.
Of course you were.
Oh, you remember that?
Oh, I remember
my
that.
God,
yes.
I
you and Joey.
Frank crazy. Frank wanted to kill me.
Yes.
Like, he can do it. I said, like, Frank, you're big enough. But you know how to borrow. You know how to grasp to get me. But the funny thing about it is that making a good player to what he was.
Yeah.
Frank Thomas, nobody wore that uniform. Harold Baines, Pudge.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We see a lot of guys, Hall of Famers, but Frank Thomas, no chance. Everybody.
Two down in the inning. DJ, you've got the final word here. Two outs, hopefully
you know
a quick out here coming.
The thing that that means the most to me, Ozzy and I were teammates. I know Ozzy. I knew him as a player, how he held everybody accountable in the locker room, had fun on the field, but was out there to win, and that's what he demanded of the players when they played for him. Play the game the right way. He'd leave you alone. Go do your job. Write the lineup up and let you guys go play. But the thing is, Pods, Ozzy, is that lineup was built to win. You were in a position to start things off. Iguchi behind you, Dye, Konerko, Creedy, all these guys were winners. It was like the perfect lineup bullpen. Everybody had career years, it seems, in the bullpen. All these things took place. But that had to be the most special thing for you guys to be part of and see develop as basically a perfect team that year.
It was. And what was so special about it is the group of guys we had, right? I mean, we were probably not the most talented team assembled in 2005. But you bring up that point. We had a good group of guys that enjoyed being around one another. We were a tight-knit group. There was a competitive spirit and a competitive fire burning amongst all those guys, and Hawk Harrelson said it, the will to win.
Yes.
That group had the will to come to the ballpark each and every night and lay it out on the ballpark.
The reason I know what the team was, I watched the lineup in the opposite team, the playoff, and I got tears in my eyes. I swear to God, I'm emotional right now. I'm 61 years old.
Yeah.
And my granddaughter said, I love you, abuelo. I start crying. But with the lineup we're seeing and the pitching style we were facing, we're not supposed to win one game.
Yeah.
We don't. Like, man by man, Hall of Famers and stuff, but they know how better team than we have.
That's right.
Yes. Because of that spirit and of that group,
that's
when
it
came together as one, we played. You know, you hear the cliche about teams and putting guys together, but that group worked well with one another, and it was a special year from start to finish.
No question.
It reminds me the Marlins. The Marlins went to the World Series with the best team. Best team on the field, but because there was the Marlins, like,
yes. Giants will beat them. Cubs will beat them. Yankees will beat them.
It's like everybody. All of a sudden, the Marlins got a better ball club than anybody.
Yes.
A club. You look in the infield, never better infield. That's why I give so much credit to the White Sox team, because the Marlins win because they have the best infield in baseball. Watch out. Best infield. Best pitching staff. They have the best guy behind the plate, and they should win. But when there was the Marlins, there was a surprise for a lot of people.
And I just left the room with that 25-some-odd guys, and it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
You know, when we just get a good group together, you could just feel, and you're swapping stories, and how are you doing, and we're talking about injuries and this and that, and nothing has changed.
Manzardo takes a walk.
Do you know what changed?
2-1 Cleveland.
I don't remember the kids. They was babies.
Yeah.
Oh, the song. Joe Creasy, this is my daughter. I was so embarrassing because I know Creedy, and they say, oh, I thought you got boys. And it was opposite. Then I see, my God, it's just all the kids I'm down there. Burley's kid, the show, when he threw the perfect game, his baby was like, what?
Right.
I don't know. A couple months old, done on the song. I see this, a woman.
Yeah.
Then I say, you know what?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah,
I'm getting old.
But I can say the same thing about your kids for me.
Yes.
Sure. You know, when you came back here and your kids to me were youngsters.
Baby. And now they have kids and a grandpa. You know,
it's
time change, but with a good thing.
Yeah.
When we talk about, I don't know, tomorrow, oh, my God, I don't cry seeing Burley.
Yeah.
I cry when I see his daddy.
Oh, I know.
His family.
John,
I start crying.
Yeah.
But tomorrow, I don't know, you will cry?
I might.
I thought you were going to cry when I walked through the door over here. You weren't happy to see me?
I love you, bro. Hey, listen. Because the thing is, we keep in touch after that. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
But you know, see, Damaso Marte, Vizcaíno.
That's right.
All those guys, like, are you guys still alive?
Yeah.
Yes. When you hug those guys, obviously you're going to be sensitive.
I've said this to Len, and for us as broadcasters, at that moment, at that time, back in 2005 and years after that, we had friendships with you guys. I've played golf with Scotty Pods. Ed Farmer and I played golf with Scotty. I played golf with you. I mean, we've had friendships. It wasn't just I was up here doing my job, but it was different. Baseball was a little different then.
More fun.
And, you know, today's ball player is a little different than when they're dealing with us as broadcasters. But, you know, our relationships from the 20 years ago to me, it's still, I have friendships with all you guys, and it's amazing.
Well, I was... God was like, what's up? Well, it wasn't really my league. I was a coach.
Yes.
Then we went to Milwaukee and they go, oh, why don't my friends go?
Yes.
Then a couple of days later, you're going to managing. But it's so many things in baseball go to so good stuff. Even when you fail or not, they're still there.
Yes.
The first thing asked me, like, what baseball do to you? I said, nothing. I make a lot of money out of them, but also the friendship I built through the years with the play, with everybody in baseball.
Big crowd here tonight. The 05 reunion is tomorrow. Very festive weekend here at the ballpark. So Vargas will now go to the bag, and now he backs up, and Manzardo will take off on this 3-2. Well, now Cannon will step off.
Well, this is obviously a very special reunion, 20 years. Scotty just told me a minute ago that some of these guys he hasn't seen since the 10-year reunion. And hopefully, 10 years from now, you guys have another one.
Thanks, fellas.
Gentlemen, thank you guys.
Great to see you guys.
Nice talking.
Enjoy the weekend.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you. That's Ozzie Guillen, Scott Podsednik.
Again, that was back on July 11th. Ozzie Guillen and Scott Podsednik joining Len Casper and Darren Jackson inside the booth at Wright Field as the White Sox took on the Guardians, unveiled the Mark Burley statue on that Friday night. And then the very next day, they were on the field celebrating the White Sox 2005 World Series championship. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly. Plenty more to come right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Stream the games live on the ESPN Chicago app.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. Hey, White Sox fans, get access to the best seats at the best value and lock in a 2026 ticket plan today. Be here for the biggest matchups, exciting new promotions, and opening day on Thursday, April 2nd. Plus, enjoy flexible payment plans, savings on single games, and more. To secure your ticket plan, visit whitesox.com/2026. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly as we run through some of the best interviews and moments from this past White Sox season. The Astros were in town early in the year. And of course, the 125th anniversary of White Sox baseball coincided with the 20th anniversary of the White Sox World Series championship team. And of course, Jeff Blum, who is the television analyst for the Astros, had a huge role in the White Sox 2005 World Series win. And it was my pleasure to chat with Jeff Blum earlier this year as we reminisced about that fantastic run for the White Sox and his critical moment for the White Sox.
Jeff, we were just chatting a bit off the air here, and it's funny because the White Sox are, of all the teams you played, 14 years in the majors, roughly?
Right at 13.
Okay, you spent plenty of time in the majors, and the White Sox are actually the team that you spent the shortest amount of time with, but you certainly left your legacy, because with that homer and a World Series championship, it's the only World Series you won. It has to be pretty cool coming back to Chicago.
No, yeah, it's crazy to think that being here 3 months and having the impact with one swing like that is, that's something that's out of our hands. That's something that is, that you dream about, and I actually fulfilled that dream. But to be able to do it in a city like Chicago, obviously, is amazing. And to do it with that group of guys that were here in 2005 was even better. It doesn't feel like it was 20 years ago. It's amazing to me that that memory, hearing Joe Buck's voice, mm-hmm. and reminiscing about that, it does not feel like 20 years ago. It still feels like yesterday.
No, it really does. And you know, for me, I'm a lifelong White Sox fan. To have you guys do that in that season. And the dominant postseason run, Jeff, when you were going through
Nobody talks about it. It drives
enough,
me crazy.
Right? Like,
yeah.
Don't even get us started about ESPN occasionally forgetting to put the graphic up, but I'll digress. Yeah,
Shocking. The
dominant run that you guys put on in the playoffs, I mean, at what point did you, because you were traded at the trade deadline to the White Sox, at what point did you feel, all right, this is something here. I'm getting in at the perfect time.
Well, what's crazy is I was on a first-place team in San Diego when I got traded over, and I looked at the standings on July 31st when I get traded. I'm like, dude, these guys are up by 15. What the hell am I going to bring to this ball club? And I show up, and it was – I'm like, how are these guys winning this many ball games? And it was just kind of this ragtag concoction of guys that went out there. We were a mess off the field in a good way. It was highly entertaining, and they just kind of absorbed me into the mess, and it was great. It was just magical. But every time the first pitch was thrown, all of a sudden there was a gear or something that shifted in that dugout. It shifted on the field into, we don't care who's on the other side of the field. We are going to run through you as hard as we possibly can to win ball games. And then we get to the postseason and absolutely, you know, abuse the reigning World Series champions and the Boston Red Sox.
Yep.
We destroyed them in this ballpark, and then El Duque had that magical entrance and finished off a bases-loaded situation.
Hocus pocus. We'll never forget that moment.
It was crazy. And it looked like he floated out of the bullpen onto the field and just you know, took care of business. But when we were sitting there after game four, after sweeping the Astros in the World Series, there was a little bit of exhaustion in it. Mm-hmm. But there was also a realization that, like, damn, dude, we just went 11-1 against the best teams in baseball. And 20 years later, I firmly believe that they do not talk about it often enough, that how dominant that team was.
No, it's one of the great reasons why I'm actually so happy to be able to be here on the 20th anniversary of that season, because we're doing a lot of retrospective this year. John Garland, Aaron Rowan were just in the booth the other day. Obviously, two key members. You mentioned it, though. It's funny because, you know, you had a lot of great players.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like there was like no clear top 10 player in baseball on that roster. It was just a bunch of guys who were good baseball players. And I think it kind of it emphasized, hey, baseball is a team game, mm-hmm. and you need everybody kind of pulling in the right direction. And it was so fun to just watch it as a Sox fan.
Yeah, and you forget about the four complete games in the ALCS against the Angels to get to the World Series. But you're right. And that game three couldn't be, you know, that was the emphasis of what you're talking about, knowing that it basically took all 25 guys to go out there and win that ball game. You know, you've got Mark Burley coming out of the bullpen and saving that game after pitching, you know, starting game one. So, I mean, there were just so many things that were happening throughout the course of that series that made us realize that we were doing something special. But that's the beauty of that, too, is 20 years later, that's a bond that never will change. I've seen guys in the offseason. I've seen guys during the season. I'm mm-hmm. slapping Aaron Rowan in the back in the home TV booth. And it's not turn around, oh, hey, Jeff. It's like, come here, brother, and give a big old hug. So, I mean, that's what's kind of created. Same thing with Ozzie, Harold Baines down on the field. I mean, there was a certain bond and kinship that will never be matched on that team.
Well, and the truth is that's the one thing where, like, fans, like, when your team goes on to win a World Series, like, Sox fans can basically run off that entire roster, the entire 25-man roster that was in the playoffs. And, you know, there's a lot of great players who didn't necessarily get a chance to win a World Series, who they're not the folk heroes that someone like Jeff Blum is when he comes back to town because of a home run in that moment.
Mm-hmm. No, there's guys in the Hall of Fame that will never have never had the opportunity to say, I played in a World Series game. And one of the funniest things is later in my career, about 2011, 2012, I think a young Paul Goldschmidt gets called up to the big leagues. He's a Houston guy, grew up in the Woodlands. We start talking. And he starts rattling off some of these teams that I played on throughout the course of my career. And we get to talking about the World Series. We beat his team in the World Series. And I said, Paul, I go, you're going to run into guys that you love in this league. You're going to run into guys that you absolutely abhor and hate in this league that you want to destroy on a daily basis. But there isn't one guy in the big leagues that I did not wish could play in the World Series.
Yeah.
Just because being on that stage and realizing the hard work and how much time and effort, energy, and you know how seasons have to come together to be able to put you in that position.
Sure.
I wish everybody could, every ball player who's played at this level could get into that situation because there was nothing like it. Never will be.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. Jeff Blum joining me here for a few more moments on ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. How much guff do you take from Houston being the analyst on TV who actually homered against them? Now, maybe. You know, we were just talking too about how you kind of came in at the right time with this Houston squad, which is now, you know, seven straight ALCSs, a couple World Series titles. So is it easier for them now that they've won a few and they can kind of let it go?
Yeah, I got the job in 2013. And from 2013 to 2017, if I ever said just 2005, if I referenced just the year, not what team or who was doing what, my ex or Twitter feed would just absolutely get just crushed. People
effing Blum. I can't believe he's an analyst for our team.
No, I there are people within the organization that were like, why did we even hire this guy?
Oh, man.
Because of that one swing. So it's taken a lot of work to be able to endear myself again to the Houston fan base. I had really good years when I played there with Houston. Obviously, I was trying my tail off to go out there and win a World Series when I was there in 2002-03. But I'll never apologize for that home run because nobody ever apologized for me getting traded from Houston out of Houston. And, you know, this is how things happen. But 2017, the Astros go on their run. They're getting into the postseason, and they win the chance to go to the World Series. And I'm very good friends with A.J. Hinch. Mm-hmm. And you can say what you want about that 2017 team. But at that time, in that moment, I walked over to him, and I said, hey, man. And I grabbed his arm, and I was like, firm. I'm like, you could do me a real solid right now if you could just go ahead and win this World Series, man, because that would take a lot of heat off me. So obviously the success of the team and being able to be, you know, one of the voices on those highlights and everything that's been going on over the last 8 to 10 years has really kind of softened the blow of what happened in 2005.
That was my conversation with Jeff Blum at Rate Field earlier this year as we reminisced about the White Sox winning the 2005 World Series and, of course, his key role with that huge home run for the White Sox, which I think at that moment really did signify that the White Sox were going to go ahead and win the World Series. At least it felt like it at that moment to me and plenty of White Sox fans out there. Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly as we recap the 2025 season right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The Sox on your phone, the ESPN Chicago app.
Jeff Meller wrapping up White Sox Weekly. Hey, Sox fans, looking for the best way to start your game day? Join us next season and treat your group to a pregame patio party. You'll get 2 hours of an all-you-can-eat buffet, along with unlimited beer, wine, and Coca-Cola products. For more information, visit whitesox.com/party areas or call 312-674-1000. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly as we wrap it up. Again, if you missed it, the big news for the White Sox earlier this week is that they announced that the team will not renew the contracts of coaches Ethan Katz, Marcus Thames, Jason Bourgeois, and Drew Butera. But Grady Sizemore has been offered a role within the organization for the 2026 season. Of course, the White Sox in their statement said, quote, while we greatly appreciate all that Ethan, Marcus, Jason, and Drew have done for this organization, Will and I have agreed on the very difficult decision to make several changes to our coaching staff in 2026. That is from Chris Getz, White Sox general manager. Quote, our respect for these coaches as people and as professionals made these decisions very difficult, and we thank them for their many contributions. Our commitment remains to provide the best possible vision, ideas, and resources to our players to support their continuing growth and development. So there you go, the White Sox news from this week. Quickly before we close up shop, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Well, that's going to close out this edition of White Sox Weekly, but we're back again next week for another hour on Saturday. Want to say thank you to Jack McGrath for producing this week. I am Jeff Meller. Thanks for listening. This is the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.